The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now at 22 minutes to 10, I want to introduce you to Clodagh Dunlop. Good morning, Clodagh.
Morning, Ryan.
And thank you for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Your story is quite something, so let's get down to business, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Give us a flavour, Clodagh, if you would, of your life up until what happened. That is to say, about 4 years ago, what were you doing for a living and how were things going generally?
I was a fit, active frontline police officer up in Derry. I absolutely loved life. I ran 4.5 miles every day and enjoyed travelling the world.
What age were you?
35.
And were you in a relationship or were you single or what was happening there?
I had a partner of 2 years and we enjoyed travelling. We had just finished travelling for 6 weeks around Africa, living out of a tent.
So you were at the extra active end of active.
At that time I enjoyed jumping out of an aeroplane, skydiving. I was an adrenaline junkie.
And life as a police officer in the service there, were you enjoying your job or was it stressful? How was it for you, broadly speaking?
Do you know, I love my job. Frontline policing is interesting and it's challenging at times, but I absolutely loved my role.
And your partner was in the same business?
He was, yes.
So that probably helped a little bit too, I suppose, at the end of a long day. And then let's go down, get to the point where, if you don't mind, you over the course of a few weeks or months, you suffered from a series of what?
I took a few mini strokes in early April 2015.
Yeah.
I attended A&E and they were misdiagnosed as fatigue. And I accepted that diagnosis because I worked long hours as a police officer. But ultimately then, on the 6th of April 2015, a clot dislodged from the vertebral artery in my neck and travelled up into my brainstem, where it became stuck and stopped the flow of blood to my brain. And I had a major stroke and woke up in intensive care with locked-in syndrome.
Good Lord. I mean, so this is what they call a brainstem stroke, I understand.
Yes.
And when you woke up, can you bring us inside your head, Clodagh, for a moment? Because none of us that I know of, I don't know anyone who has had locked-in syndrome. But can you give us a sense of your eyes open, you're there, what are you seeing or thinking or feeling?
Your eyes open and it's initially surreal. I'm relieved that I'm alive. I query, where am I? Because it's... intensive care is like a spaceship, or it's like it's a movie set almost, and you establish where you are. And there was a part of me was relieved that I had been right, that there was something wrong with me, but my body was gripped by pain, and then I became terrified. I wanted to scream out for help, but nothing would move. I couldn't make a sound, and simply it was harrowing. I was more helpless than a newborn baby. I couldn't kick out. I couldn't scream. There were tubes incubating me, breathing for me. My tongue was pressed on my teeth, wires coming from both my arms, and I could hear people talking and walking past, and there was simply nothing that I could do.
I can't imagine. So you were completely conscious of your surroundings, of who was coming in to see you, what they were saying, all of that?
Yep, completely conscious. I was, imagine yourself as you are now,
yes.
Just being unable to move, unable to make a sound. So if you're uncomfortable, if you've an itch or you've a pain, that you can simply do nothing about it.
And when people came in to see you then, Clodagh, were they aware that you were conscious and compos mentis?
Not initially,
really?
No. On that first day... I was wheeled for CT scans and nurses were going about their job and no one talked to me. Everyone was talking over me. But it was when my partner visited me and he looked directly at me and he asked me, Clodagh, are you there? If you are, can you blink once for yes? And that was terrifying because I knew that nothing in my body moved. I had no control over anything. I knew my eyes had been open from I was awake, but I didn't know if I had any control over my eyelids. And that moment, I thought, I can't get this wrong. I need to be able to blink. And I remember concentrating really hard to close my eyes and then open them as wide as I could. And I was so relieved whenever my partner told me, you're going to be okay, Clodagh. I knew you were there.
It almost has to feel, it feels to me that though you were like almost kidnapped by your own body and you were trying to make communication with the outside world by hook or by crook.
I often say it's like, I felt like an astronaut detached from their spaceship drifting off into the solar system, screaming out for help in the world beneath me, but no one could hear me and I was alone.
You talk about the humiliation, at least the initial humiliation and frustration. What sort of things did you find unbearable, in a sense?
I'd gone from being a front active, frontline police officer, and I was a young woman at 35 years of age, and I remember finding it really shocking, and I guess illness is humbling when I'd woken in intensive care and you were given bed baths and I wore an adult nappy and just you became very aware of your nakedness when you would feel the cold fat on you and people washing you, and that was shocking for me and I had no control over it. As a woman, I was upset that I had no control over my choice of bedwear. Couldn't choose my pyjamas.
What did they put you in?
I remember when I woke in intensive care being horrified. I was wearing a nightdress. I thought, my mother has sent this and it must be a new nightdress belonged to my grandmother.
Okay, as if the other humiliations weren't enough, is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It was like, oh, where did this nightdress come from?
Could you cry?
My sister often described my cries as the most painful thing she ever had to watch. I had a silent cry, simply my mouth might have opened a little and the tears would roll down my face, but I made no sound and no other movement. And my tears would sting my eyes and tears would roll down my face behind my neck, and crying almost became a form of torture for myself.
Because of the pain of it?
The discomfort of it.
Yes.
If you can imagine, when you have tears in your eyes, you instinctively wipe your eyes. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't lift a hand to do that. And I was lying in a bed, unable to adjust my position or my head. So when my tears rolled down my face, they would roll down behind your neck. And there was nothing I could do to wipe them. And it's surprising just how irritating your own tears can be when they roll down behind your ear.
I can imagine, as if it wasn't bad enough in the first instance. You mentioned your sister Diane there, and she was a godsend because, and I think anyone who spent any period of time in hospital will know the importance of the dignity of the everyday things that a man or a woman wants in life, and she did that.
She was brilliant. She knew that, like any young woman, I would be worried about how my eyebrows looked and how my hair was and were my legs shaved, and she would attend hospital and pluck my eyebrows and shave my legs and make sure that my hair was okay and that I was happy with it. Bizarrely, when you're locked in, you still have a little bit of vanity wondering, how do I look to the outside world?
Well, I don't think it's vanity. I think you're entitled to that little bit of self-respect, I suppose. Let me ask you about Adrian. He did something very interesting that you described there a few minutes ago, which was, Clodagh, this idea of him arriving into the hospital, everyone talking over you like you were kind of barely not there. And he looked you in the eye and said, "Are you in there?" You described the difficulty, but the need to get that blink down. Did you then develop a communication through blinking with him?
We developed a system of blinks. So it was one blink for yes, two blinks for no, three blinks for I love you, and four blinks for you're a moron.
How often was the four blink technique required?
I think I used it a lot, but people chose to ignore it. But I always say, if you can imagine in a day, if all you could say was yes, no, I love you, and you're a moron, how much would go unsaid? And you're at the mercy of everybody around you asking you the right closed questions. So there is nothing further you can communicate. You can't say, I'm hot, I'm uncomfortable.
You were 6 weeks with locked-in syndrome, a syndrome that I've never heard of anyone coming out of. And yet you made this very peculiar sound one day that I think took you by surprise. Could you describe that to me, for me?
My best friend had been not very good at using the spell board, and in my frustration at her, I wanted to scream at her, and suddenly from nowhere I made a sound somewhat like a dying pig, she would say. For me, that was the best sound ever.
And that came out, isn't it just as well your best friend was useless at the board?
It really was.
Strangely.
Sometimes I'm so grateful that she frustrated me so much, because I wonder if she hadn't have, where would I be now?
Yeah. And how do we go from that awful guttural sound to coming out of locked in, to be unlocked?
It was the first indication that maybe I might, you know, recover. And it was enough for me to keep working at it. So every day I would lie in my hospital bed, simply staring at the ceiling, unable to move, continuously making that sound like a dying pig, because I knew I want to talk again. It's horrific and horrendous how vulnerable just you are when you can't communicate or indicate to anyone what's wrong with you. And I would lie all day making strange noises, and nurses initially would come running and offer to help and ask what's wrong. But suddenly, slowly, everybody realised, no, she's trying to talk again. And it's really been a long process, learning to talk again, retraining all my mouth muscles, my swallow.
But it took, what, about 7 months altogether?
Do you know, it took longer than that. I was in hospital for 7.5 months, and I was just discharged from hospital, taking steps, and I could talk, but I wasn't completely intelligible. Mm-hmm. And the steps I were taking, if you'd touch me with a finger, I would have fallen over, and it was thought at that time I would be in an electric wheelchair forever. But when I got home, I worked at it every day for hours on my recovery, and I would watch television and sing and talk, and talking became an obsession to improve my speech.
For all of that endeavour to get better, there was this very dark moment where you were just, I think you were having a rough time with Adrian. You hated the fact that he was your carer, and he came home and found you one day doing what?
When I was discharged from hospital, I had lived for that moment for 7.5 months to get home from hospital. Yeah. And Adrian had worked for it too. You know, we'd worked so hard to get me home. And maybe there was a little part of us naive where we didn't fully appreciate life wouldn't be as it was before. Once I got home, I'd gone from having physiotherapy, speech and language therapy all day, every day, and nurses caring for me, to just being Adrian. And simply everything, he had to do everything, and everything he did irritated me. He didn't squeeze the tea bags right. If he helped me put on my shoes, they weren't quite on right. When he made the bed, it wasn't made just quite how I liked it. And I worried that I wasn't going to get any better, and I'd felt so low that at that time I wondered, would I be better off dead?
And you took it a step further than wondering, didn't you?
I did, but thankfully he came along and found me, and it was a moment where I think both of us were really honest with each other, where I had said, you know, I didn't want to live like this. And Adrian was always very good, very logical. And as he said to me, Clodagh, you know this isn't going to get better overnight. You need to work at it. And he's been a real source of strength for me. And when I've been low, he's been very realistic, and he knows that I respond well to common sense.
And what a response you've made. Can you put a little bit of your life in context for us this morning, please, Clodagh? What have you been doing since all of this desperate experience?
I would always say that life is richer now. I am back at work full time as a detective in the Police Service of Northern Ireland,
Amazing.
and I have an adapted trike and I enjoy cycling. Yes, I can't run 4.5 miles anymore, but life is richer. I enjoy my friendships, my family, relationships with people much more. And it's funny, you're talking about kindness on the show before. I would say that I'm a kinder person now, and I understand that when people maybe aren't receptive or grumpy with you, that they perhaps have their own troubles, and we don't know what's going through anybody's head in a day. So I'm always pleasant and nice and offer everyone a smile.
Isn't it terrible that it took that experience in some ways? I'm not judging you, Clodagh, but for all of us, it takes a terrible experience sometimes for us to realize actually it's a much nicer and easier position default wise to be a bit kinder.
Do you know, it has really taught me to appreciate the small things in life.
Sure.
I had no control over my arms, so I couldn't brush my own hair. And now I can do my own hair. I can brush my own teeth. Just simply to be able to scratch an itch. I can decide what station I want to listen to on the radio. When you're lying in intensive care or in the stroke ward, or when you're locked in, you have absolutely no control over your environment. So I wasn't like an ordinary patient where I could flick through a magazine, I could choose what television program to watch. And I just appreciate my environment so much more. And I would say that I really appreciate Ireland so much more. I went skydiving on my year anniversary from taking the stroke, because dinner didn't seem really to be an appropriate thing to mark the occasion. You almost died. And when I got, well, when I was hurtled out of a Cessna plane and was descending down over the province, I was like, it blew me away just how beautiful the green checkered fields were. And I don't think I fully appreciated how beautiful our country was until I had a stroke.
I find your story remarkable, Clodagh. I'm so happy for you, and for Adrian, and that you came out the other side.
Thank
It's
you.
absolutely a knockout story, and the lessons you've learned, you're teaching us a lot of things this morning, and I'm opening my eyes, no doubt about it. I can't wish you enough happiness in your life, and have a lovely Christmas with
Thank
you and
you,
your
Ryan.
family.
Same to you.
Really nice to talk to you today, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you so much. Clodagh Dunlop joining us on the programme this morning. She's written a book about her experience, and it features photographs also of her and in hospital in the middle of it all, and then out the other side. The strength, both emotional, moral and physical, is extraordinary. It's called A Return to Duty. That can be bought online at beatinglockedin.com and, of course, in Waterstones. So that was quite the story, was it not? It's 3 minutes to 10.